Yes.
Will the movement toward renewables, in your opinion, make it more likely that this refocusing of large numbers of slaves to small ones just happen because the amount of energy output that you can look forward to from renewables is considerably less than you get from a barrel of water?
I think you're absolutely right. So the question is, if we move towards renewables and their capacity for energy output is much less than that of hydrocarbons, will we then move towards actually employing fewer energy slaves and perhaps restore a role for the use of really purposeful human energy in a lot of our affairs? I would hope so. But because there's no way we can replace the amount of energy we are now burning with fossil fuels with renewables. It is impossible. There's no way we can even scale it up. So we are going to have to dramatically reduce the number of energy slaves in our household as well as the amount of energy we now burn. In all forms. Yep.
Missing from this very helpful presentation is the critique of capitalism.
All right.
And there's a very enlightening book called What Every Environmentalist Should Know About Capitalism that shows that much of the phenomenon you're describing is actually linked to the role of capitalism as an economic system and state capitalism, as you see in some of the formerly so-called socialist countries. So, given the need of the capitalist class to accumulate and the need to drive this whole set of forces that you're describing, could you comment on that?
Yeah. Okay, so the question is about capitalism and the drive of the elites in capitalist societies to accumulate capital and wealth. And we think of capitalism as it's all about the money and who's going to get the money. Fred Cotterill, the U.S. sociologist I talked about in the 1950s, he came up with a different definition for capitalism, which I kind of like. And he said, really, capitalism is an economic system that creates new machines and new innovations that require the consumption of more cheap energy. And capitalism is basically something that's been around since the 1750s. And it arose with hydrocarbons, particularly in England, and this new cheap supply of energy. So if we think of capitalism as a form of the employment of cheap energy through machines and the multiplication of these machines, in other words, we all need more and more machines in order to consume more and more cheap energy, then it sort of it changes my thinking a bit about it. But so that's one layer of it. You still have the money issue, and the money issue is all related to the flow of energy. The more energy flowing through the system, the more capital is going to be generated, and of course, just like in any society, you're going to find people who are very adept at accumulating huge amounts of this capital. We now are seeing just incredible inequities in the accumulation of this capital that we have to address in one form or another. And we're going to see these inequities grow as the flow of energy in the system becomes more constrained and becomes more expensive. And I think the social and political unrest you see in Europe, the social and political unrest you see in Japan, both are oil-importing places, the social and political unrest you're beginning to see more and more in the United States, is a reflection of these changes in energy flow. And I would argue that how do we deal with this in many places? I mean, communities might opt out of the system altogether and say, all right, we need a cooperative form of energy production for our community. We need something that's community-based, community-owned, as opposed to a big corporation or big government delivering the services. So,
yeah. I've heard that it was either in the 20s or 30s that the world was on the verge of having a population bigger than the food supply, and then fertilizer, petroleum-based fertilizer was invented, and that has enabled our population boom. Comment on that.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the use of fertilizers were actually developed after World War I, and it was the developed in Germany, and it came out of the armaments program, and so they developed a way to synthesize ammonia and use it in either from coal or from natural gas. And as a result, you know, you were able to really increase yields with these hydrocarbon-based fertilizers. And that has played a very powerful role in supporting this growing world population. So it's another aspect of the whole hydrocarbon story and how cheap energy has really allowed us to overpopulate the Earth, because that's essentially what we've done. Yes?
I thought you said you're going to leave us with a sense of hope.
Well,
you draw out some of the hope okay. that you see.
Well,
I'm having a difficulty.
Well, I mean the hopeful part is there are many. I understand what you're saying, but the hopeful part is really that I mean we've been over consuming energy, all right, and we've become oversized, and that we, you know, we can actually be much happier by consuming less energy, but we are going to have to reorganize our lives. Back in many ways, it'll be a combination of 21st and also 19th century living. So we will do more stuff communally. We will do we will employ fewer and fewer energy slaves and very particular ones that can, you know, we will prioritize what is important. We'll be growing more of our own food, and more food will be grown locally. We will require more and more farmers. Right, and good purposeful work in farming. Our cities will probably become smaller because they will not be sustainable at the scale they have been built. Suburbs will, in many ways, be the hardest hit in this kind of reorganization. We'll be able to address climate change very successfully with these dramatic reductions in energy use and also with the number of energy slaves we use. So I'm hopeful about all these things. But let me tell you perhaps a story that's probably the best way to address with this. So after the collapse of Rome, the people abandoned the city. And one of the folks that kind of walked away from the mess that ancient Rome had become was a fellow by the name of Benedict. And Benedict was the son of very wealthy Roman parents. And he walked away from the mess that was Rome, and he established a Christian community in southern Italy and founded essentially the Benedictine order. And what was interesting about the Benedictine order was that St. Benedict realized, first of all, he had to deal with the legacy of slavery in Rome. And one of the legacies there was that nobody wanted to work with their hands. So he required every member of his order to work at least 5 hours a day doing manual labor at the Benedictine community. And then the rest of the time, and then they would pool their labor, right? So everyone would get involved in all the dirty work, or, you know, someone would clean the latrines and someone would peel the potatoes and, you know, someone would be, you know, so all of that stuff would be done, the kitchen work, and then the rest of the day would be spent doing other things. So, and in the case of the Benedictines, it was quite often they would be doing artful work. They would be involved in prayer, involved in discussions, involved. So your day, it wasn't a 24/7 day. It was a very well-ordered day. And so Benedict, in a way, created a new model for communities to live, based on the fact that you can't employ shackled human muscle to get stuff done, but you have to be part of a community that shares all this stuff so that everyone has a chance to experience art and beauty and to have that spiritual conversation they need. That was one response to a cheap energy system that got too complex, fell apart, and collapsed. Might not be a bad model for us to think about. Yeah.
Can you give us some idea of what the sentiment is in Alberta towards the open mind here? I mean, it seems like you kind of get a mixed message here in the U.S. On the one hand, you hear that the people of Alberta are supporting it, and then on the other hand, you hear about people who are very much against it.
Well, okay, that's a good question. So the Albertans are divided. And the country is divided on this issue. But I would say you've got about a third of the population of Alberta that is directly involved in producing hydrocarbons. They either work in Fort McMurray or they're drilling for oil or gas elsewhere in the province. They support the project 100%. Then you've got about 60% of the population that's not really directly involved in the oil and gas business. And I would say, not all of them, but a great many of them have questions about the pace and scale. They are dramatically concerned about the pace and scale of development. You go elsewhere in Canada, where in British Columbia, the majority of British people in BC are opposed to pipelines running across their province. And they have serious questions about the pace and scale of development. You go to Eastern Canada, or let's say first, let's go to Ontario and Quebec. That's our manufacturing center. They've been hammered by the appreciating Canadian dollar due to oil exports, and they have great concerns about the petrocurrency and what it's done to their manufacturing base, which is killing it. It means that they can't be competitive anymore. You go to Eastern Canada, where there's a lot of folks, after the collapse of the cod fishery, they're now working in the mines in Fort McMurray. And they're conflicted because they're thinking, you know, they'll work there for 2 weeks and then fly back home, and which is not much of a life. Yet at the same time, they're making good dollars. So, you know, that by and large, I think the country would agree that the pace and scale development of the tar sands is out of hand. It must be slowed down, and that Canada must seriously address climate change issues. That would be the majority sentiment. But governments such as the government of Alberta, the government of Saskatchewan, the government of Newfoundland, which derive more than 30% of their income from hydrocarbons, Newfoundland is 50%, Saskatchewan is probably around 12%, Alberta is 30%, they're gung-ho for these projects. And the federal government, of course, is gung-ho for these projects because it's, you know, they figure they don't have to tax people if they can get hydrocarbon revenue instead.
Well, we're going to have to end here. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you.